Okay, you have heard of the incredibly successful Chicken Soup for the Soul series. Hundreds of millions of copies worldwide. In a moment, the co-author of the series, Jack Canfield, joins us. His latest work, The Golden Motorcycle Gang, and William Gladstone, who's been on the program before, will be joining us because he co-wrote this book with Jack, A Story of Transformation. I'm sure all of us have tried to ask ourselves, what are we doing on this planet anyway? We'll be back with Jack in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Jack Canfield is the co-author of the number one New York Times best-selling Chicken Soup for the Soul series, which has sold more than 500 million copies in 47 languages. He's a featured teacher in the movie The Secret. Jack is also the CEO of the Canfield Training Group and founder of the Transformational Leadership Council as well. He co-wrote a book we're going to talk about tonight with William Gladstone as well, The Golden Motorcycle Gang. Let's bring in Jack Canfield. Jack, a delight. How are you?
My pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
It's so great, by the way. Technology is so incredible. I was looking at some of your work, and they've got a barcode where you can just rub your phone across it, and I saw your video message. And it's amazing how far we have gone with technology these days, isn't it?
It is truly amazing. We're going to have textbooks now that college students read where they'll do that, and they'll actually see videos of different things that they're reading about in their book. So it's pretty amazing.
Jack, let me ask you a little bit about the Chicken Soup series while we've got you before Bill comes in next hour with us.
Sure.
The title, you got that from your grandmother, I guess, right?
Well, actually, kind of. But what happened was we didn't have a title. We were about to go to New York to try to sell the book, and there's just a bunch of stories that were motivational and inspirational. And so Mark Victor Hansen, my co-author, and I, we decided we would meditate and ask for a title. And so I would go inside every day for about 3 days. It happened on the third day. And I was just sitting there meditating, and all of a sudden this chalkboard, like in school, appeared in my mind. And a hand came out and wrote Chicken Soup. And I said, I said to the hand, what the heck does Chicken Soup have to do with this book? And it said, when you were sick, your grandmother gave you chicken soup. I said, this is not a book about sick people. And it said, people's spirits were sick. It was right during the 1993 first recession that came along with the Gulf War.
That's right.
And I said, okay, so chicken soup for the spirit. Then I thought, chicken soup for the soul, and I got goosebumps. I told my wife she got goosebumps. I told Mark he got goosebumps. I told my agent he got goosebumps. We went to New York and had 22 meetings, and nobody got goosebumps. So it took us a year to sell that book. We had 144 rejections before we were able to get a publisher.
144?
Uh-huh.
My God. I don't even think there are that many publishers left anymore, are there?
There are actually 4,000 publishers at the moment in America.
Oh, my God. Unbelievable.
Yeah, no, it was unbelievable. We just, you know, what happened was we went to the American Booksellers Association in Anaheim, California the following year, and went from booth to booth to booth. There were 4,000 booths there of publishers, and it was late on the second day. A little publisher in Florida said, well, we'll read it. And they said they thought they'd sell 20,000 copies. And we said, well, we think we're going to sell 1.5 million in a year and a half. And the guy laughed at us. I don't know if you've ever shared a dream with someone and had him laugh out loud at you. And he did.
Yeah, well, look what you did.
Yeah, it's fun. We did this number, 500 million, which almost seems insane. Came about because a couple years ago, the Chinese bought the rights to all 225 books in the series, and they published them all in Chinese, all in English, and all with Chinese on one page and English on the next, facing each other so they can teach English to kids in the Chinese schools.
Well, the books are so helpful in every different way, and you have now dealt with so many different aspects of transformation and things that we all go through in our life. When you first started doing this, Jack, did you ever expect it to be this big?
No. We really intended to have a best-selling book, and we believe in visualizing and intention and doing the actions that are required, and we did all that. But, you know, we thought we'd do maybe a book with two or three sequels, and that would be it. And people just kept sending us stories. I mean, sometimes we get, you know, 100 to 300 letters a day in the mail with stories attached. Not all of them are good. But little by little, we just kept pushing out the books.
Well, and look what happened. And they're still growing.
It is. Yeah, we just did 10 books this last year.
Good for you. Well, you know, and what's really great is that as an author, you must feel good knowing that you're touching people.
I do. We actually have in our files over 2,000 letters of teenagers who didn't commit suicide because they read the book. Hundreds and hundreds of letters of people who started businesses, who got out of abusive marriages, who were in prison and read the books in prison and realized that they actually were responsible for being there and turned their life around. So I sleep very well at night.
Good for
Not
you.
Tonight. But
no, tonight you're going to be up all night.
Yeah, exactly.
I hope you don't have an early morning speaking engagement, Jack.
I don't. Fortunately, I don't speak until 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
Oh, you should be okay.
I'm good.
You know, are you sensing right now across the country that people are acting weird, whacked out, upset, stressed? I've never seen it this bad.
Yeah, I think it's true. I think there's two reasons for that. Number one, the environment is such that we have such unemployment. We have a Congress that doesn't work. We have all these people that are becoming awakened and alive into the fact that the system doesn't quite do what it's supposed to do. And our economic system and our political system. So people like the Occupy Wall Street people and others are just starting to go, wait a second. So there's a tremendous sense of dissatisfaction, a tremendous sense of awakening to personal empowerment that says, wait, we have to change this. Don't exactly know how, some people are saying, but we're definitely going to do something. And so a great unrest. And I think the other thing is, and that's the theme of the Golden Motorcycle book, mm-hmm. is that we are moving into a new time of energy on this planet. And that is astrological. There are physicists that say we're actually moving through different energy belts in the universe as our universe expands. And I think that, all these prophecies from the Mayans and so forth that say this is the end of a 26,000-year cycle is true. And so we're something new is emerging, and it's like when a woman's pregnant and you're getting close to birthing and there's this agitation, can't sit still. I think there's a lot of that going on.
Yells at her husband or boyfriend.
Say what?
And yells at her husband and boyfriend.
Absolutely.
As she gets close. That's happened.
I've had three boys, so I don't.
I've got three kids. Same. Yeah, we've been down that same road together.
Yeah.
The book, The Golden Motorcycle Gang, first of all, the title, what is The Golden Motorcycle Gang?
Well, what happened, George, was I was in school, in graduate school at the University of Massachusetts, and I was studying education. I was studying to be a teacher, and I took this class that included a guided visualization one day where we had to go back and remember when we had chosen to become a teacher, to get in touch with our original intention. And most everyone in the class went back to their high school history teacher who they admired, or some experience like in the summer in the civil rights movement they might have taught in a black summer camp and decided they wanted to teach. And I flipped back to before I was born and totally freaked me out. I was not expecting that. And I had this sense of flying through the universe as a bunch of spirits or souls and looking down on Earth. I was born in 1944 when World War II was going on, and looking down and seeing bombs going off and all that and going, my God, we got to go down there and help out. And so that was this sense I had. Everyone in the group was kind of an irreverent, motorcycle gang guys. They just don't kind of buckle under to the normal system.
Right.
And yet they have a lot of fun and they're free spirits. And that's how I felt. So we named that group the Golden Motorcycle Gang. And what started to happen was after maybe, 15 years after I was out of school, I started meeting people. And I'd say, oh, my God, you're part of the Golden Motorcycle Gang, because they were doing similar work. So it's a metaphorical term for people who really have a conscious awareness that they're here in this lifetime to make a difference and try to support creating a world that, is more ecologically sustainable, spiritually fulfilling, socially just, etc.
You're not a doom and gloomer. You've got an incredible outlook for the future of mankind, don't you?
I do. I've always been an optimist. I'm not quite sure why, but it's just always been part of my personality. And every time I'm optimistic about something, it seems to help bring it about, whether it's my own personal success or the success of my company or different projects I've been involved with. But I know that people are programmed to grow. Little kids want to learn to walk. They want to use the lawnmower. Daddy, can I drive the car? People want to get more competent, want to be more, contributing to make a difference. And if we unscratch all the wounds and the psychological trauma, it's all in there. I've worked with prisoners. In fact, my wife right now is doing a prison project. And everyone that comes in the room in the morning, she says, I'm afraid of them. They look like, terrible people. And by the afternoon, they're all just little kids, and I love them. So underneath all of that craziness, there's normal human beings.
Yeah, no doubt. And by the way, we may have the largest prisoner listenership to a radio show. So you're being beamed into probably every major institution now.
Well, very good.
As we talk. And you know what? I get a lot of emails from prisoners, Jack, and mm-hmm. I will respond to as many as I can. There's one aspect there that I stay away from. If they're in for, you know, being a pedophile or something, you know, that's just something I will not accept. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just shy away from them. But, you know, the other people who've been in for their own personal problems and things that they've done and they regret, they really want to learn. They're going through school. Some of them are working on degrees. And mm-hmm. I just hope when they get out, and many of them will, that there's something there for them to, you know, get out to.
Well, I hear that. You know, it's interesting. In Japan, I heard this recently, that they require people to learn to read before they can be released from prison.
That's interesting.
And it is interesting. And I think, you know, having worked in Chicago in the school systems for a couple of years, that's how I started out, I found that there was a study done at the Cook County Jail that almost 90% of all prisoners had learning disabilities, dyslexia, ADD, couldn't focus or concentrate or literally learn in school. And so they basically just said, screw it, I'm out of here. And so we have a system that doesn't identify these kids and really teach them how to learn in an alternative way so that they don't become challenges and problems in society.
Have you always been positive, even when you were a youngster? Did you always have that energy about you?
Well, my wife calls me the Energizer Bunny. You know, I do have a lot of energy and a lot of positivity. I think so. I mean, maybe not totally. My dad was an alcoholic. He was abusive. I don't know if you ever remember those huge, big radio consoles. There'd be a little radio at the top.
Oh, sure.
At the bottom, they were hollow.
Yeah.
Well, that's where I would hide when my dad got.
Oh, you're kidding.
So crazy. And he never found me there. But when he was drunk, he would beat me, you know. So
oh, my God.
Basically, I think the more of the total optimism came after I was in graduate school and I began to do a lot of therapy and workshops that were human potential oriented. And I was able to forgive my father. And he was a military guy, a lot of stress. His father was a perfectionist and overbearing. It just gets passed on until somebody breaks the chain. But I guess I was a little hyper-vigilant and scared back then. And,
sure.
But then eventually I just realized, hey, it's up to me.
When he wasn't drinking, was he a good guy?
He was. He was. And in fact, this is a very interesting story. My dad and my mom got divorced. My mom divorced him when I was six. And about 5 years ago, I get a call and from this woman who said to Mark Victor Hansen, he was giving a talk in Disneyland, and she walked up to him. He's the co-author of my Chicken Soup book.
Right,
he said,
right.
If ask Jack Canfield if his father's name was Bud, if it was, have him call me. So I did, and turns out my father had gotten divorced. We didn't know where he went. Went off to Chicago, back where he would grow up. I was living in West Virginia. And he got sober because his wife demanded it, his new wife, and raised an incredibly happy, functional family. He started the business. He was a pilot. He
wow.
flew airplanes. He was a drummer, a photographer, and they loved him. So I think when he wasn't drunk, he was fabulous, but I didn't get that much of that to him.
You didn't see that part?
No.
Yeah, that's something. Do you ever regret that he lost contact with you?
Yeah, I do. I only have a couple regrets in life, and one is that I didn't reach out to him before he died. And it was after he died that I finally had the courage to kind of reach out to him. And by then, and I didn't know this, but he had died of a heart attack. And so I regret that. I wish I had gotten to know him.
Well, and in some way, I think you make up for it with your incredible work that you do.
Well, I do. I think part of my compassion and part of my desire to make a world that works for everybody comes from my own childhood abuse and realizing that that doesn't work very well. And fortunately, I had the money and the consciousness to get some therapy and groups and so forth. But, you know, the people you're talking about in prison don't have that. My wife was talking today. She was just working with about seven Hispanic gang members in Santa Barbara in a prison, in a, you know, youth facility.
Mm-hmm.
And she was asking them, well, who do you talk to about your feelings? And they said, nobody. He said, I don't know what to do with my feelings. They're so incredible. I just either strike out and fight or I get drunk. And so there's a lot of lack of parenting and a lack of education that goes on where people don't know how to deal with those aspects of themselves.
So true. I remember years ago, I would see your books, not knowing you, I would see your books at bookstores. And I kept saying, that's a neat little title for this book. How did they do that? And it's really a treat to have you on the show tonight.
Thank you.
And we'll get an opportunity later on to take some phone calls with some of our listeners, and they're all over the place. How did you partner up with Bill Gladstone? I mean, he was an agent for a while. Now he's an author?
He's still an agent.
He's done some great books. Is he? Okay.
He's agented for, Eckhart Tolle and, you know, a number of the people that are in this work, as well as other kinds of authors. But he's amazing. I met him actually at a writer's conference in Maui. We were both presenting there. He was talking about, you know, how to find the perfect agent, and I was talking about the success of my books. And some woman who he knew wanted to do a book of Chicken Soup stories about people's dolphin experiences. A book that never did happen, but he was representing her. And some great stories, by the way, about dolphins.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And so he and I just kind of hit it off, and I said, let's go have a beer. And so we did, and we've been friends ever since.
You know, I think dolphins, if they had arms and thumbs, they would be probably more advanced than us.
I think so, yes, absolutely. Talk about intent, always happy. You know, one of the things that's amazing, I remember I was in Hawaii, and I wanted to swim with the dolphins, and a bunch of us swam out, and anybody who wanted to swim with them because they wanted to say they'd swum with the dolphins to prove how cool and conscious they were,
yeah,
the dolphins just swam away from them.
They know. How did they know this?
They seem to do it. I don't know. It's amazing.
And I've never, ever heard of a dolphin biting anybody. Have you?
No. In fact, the stories you hear about people that are out in the ocean and they get cramps and the dolphins come up under them and take them into shore. A guy was being attacked by a shark. A dolphin came up. Several dolphins just started ramming the shark, so the shark swam away. Dolphins seem to be very much connected and supportive of humans. Most people are loving toward dolphins, but, you know, obviously we catch them in our tuna nets, and not a great thing.
Higher life form, no doubt. And,
I think they're very, 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 very evolved.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We just built a studio, by the way, Jackie, on the Big Island in Hawaii.
Oh, cool.
So we're going to do some broadcasting out of there as well. The book, The Golden Motorcycle Gang, and I want to get into this a lot because it has to do with all of us, where we're all looking for some answers. I mean, people want to know what we're doing here. What's the purpose? You know, it's not just to wake up and have a job and go, you know, it's bigger than that.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get people to sit down and say, you know, my life is meaningful and there's a purpose for it, whatever it is, and to try to ascertain what it is?
Well, I think the first step is that we've never been educated, other than a few people, that we actually have a life purpose that's unique to us. So the first thing you have to do is be made aware of that concept. And then in my seminars, which I do a lot of, do some big 7-day things in the summer and then just 1-day things for corporations and so forth. But we always do a life purpose exercise, and there are probably 3 or 4 different exercises you can do, one which we've put today just on our goldenmotorcycle.com website, so anybody can go there. And just it says the life purpose exercise. It's a paper and pencil test you do where it helps you figure out what your life purpose is. It's very powerful and very simple. There's also guided visualizations where we'll have people go in and meet either a guardian angel or a wise person. It could be your grandfather who's died ahead of you, whatever.
Right.
And then ask them what your life purpose is and get a gift. And people always get something. I mean, just it's amazing. And then there's a thing that 2 of my friends developed, Chris and Janet Atwood, called the Passion Test. And it's a very good little book. It's a paperback book, and it teaches you how to identify your passions. Because what you're passionate about, what brings you joy, what you get excited about, is it nature's way of feeding back to you that this is aligned with your purpose.
Jack, hold on. I want to take this quick break, and we're going to come right back and talk about that. That's fascinating. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with Jack Canfield, talking about his latest work with William Gladstone. It's called The Golden Motorcycle Gang. We'll be right back. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Jack Canfield, a co-author of the number 1 best-selling New York Times books, The Chicken Soup for the Soul series, Also, his latest with William Gladstone is called The Golden Motorcycle Gang, a story of transformation. It's a story about you. We'll be back in a moment with Jack on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Jack, tell us again about this passion test, which is one of the three that you've got up there.
Yeah, basically what it is you answer the question, I am happiest and most fulfilled when I, and you just fill in the blank. So petting my cat, making music, playing the guitar, reading books, watching war movies, you know, whatever the heck it is. But for most people, they end up writing things like, you know, teaching others, dancing. And then what you do is after you get these 10 or, yeah, you do it for 10 of them, you then do what's called a forced choice where you go, if I could only do one but not two, which would I do? If I only do one or three, one or four, one or five, et cetera, it takes you through a little thing. What I did the first time I wrote it down, but the author took me in the cab and actually had me do it with her. I wrote that I love hanging out with highly conscious people. Mm-hmm. I love being on radio and television shows like I'm doing tonight. I love writing. I love teaching. I love coaching. I love managing my staff. And I love being with my family and so forth. But what I really had to face, which was really kind of challenging, was if I could only do my work on the planet or be with my family, I would have to choose my work. And that's a difficult thing for people, but I realized that my passion is inspiring and empowering people to live their highest vision. And so once you know what your passions are, then what you can do is you can align your goals with that. And the things that make you the happiest are the things that really are the things you're supposed to be doing. I'll give you a quick example too. Sure. Out of my book. I wrote a book called The Success Principles, in which I interviewed 75 of the most successful people in America. And I discovered this woman. She was a finalist in the Miss America contest. Her name was Julie Lapley. She was from Miss Virginia. And she was going to Ohio State to study to be a veterinarian because she loved animals mm-hmm. as a child. One day it was raining. She was feeling miserable. And she said, I hate this science that I'm studying. I hate the biochemistry. I don't know what I was thinking. When was I happiest? And she started looking back, and every time she was happy was when she was in a leadership role. So she was leading in high school. She was on the student council. She was in college. She would be the person that would do chaperoning for when the student leaders came from all the high schools to the state conference for leaders. And so she went to the university and said, I want to get a degree in leadership. And they said, well, we don't have one. And so they created one with her. She studied communication, psychology, and so forth. Well, at the age of 24, she was in the Pentagon teaching leadership to generals.
That's amazing.
It's like, and now she has a leadership foundation. She goes all around the world teaching youth how to become leaders. And she discovered that by looking back to see, when was I happiest? And you're happy doing what you're doing. I'm happy doing what I'm doing. But research shows that over 55% of Americans hate their jobs. So they're obviously doing the wrong thing. You can't just do it to make money. You have to do it also to fulfill yourself. Otherwise, you numb out. That's why people are drinking too much and watching too much TV and, you know, engaging in illicit sex and all of that.
You know, and Jack, it's the hardest thing for people to do if they're in a job that happens to pay them well, but they hate that job. How many of these people feel trapped? They don't want to lose the money. They hate the job, but they don't have the inclination or maybe the risk to go off and just do something they like because it would pay, let's say, a third of what they're making.
Well, it might, and it might not. Fact is, there are all kinds of ways to make money doing things you want to do. I started out as a high school teacher. That didn't pay very well.
That didn't pay well, no.
But then I started training teachers, and that paid better. Then I started doing teacher training courses, and I wrote books for teachers and so forth. I mean, our Chicken Soup for the Teacher Soul book sold over 6 million copies. So you can stay within the thing you love to do, and you can find ways to creatively monetize it. And you know that there are tons of people who've left the corporate world and are now doing things like teaching and farming and, you know, doing auto mechanic work. And they're not making as much money, but they're 10 times happier. They'll live longer. They sleep better at night. You know, it's really important to do what you love.
It sure is. It's healthier, too, isn't it?
Yeah, we had a guy in one of our trainings. He was miserable. He had low back pain all his life. He was just in really serious pain. And he was an anesthesiologist, of all things. His dad was a doctor. His mother was a doctor. Two of his brothers and his sister were a doctor. He was expected to become a doctor. Turns out he hated being a doctor. So in our seminar, I asked him, what did you always want to do? And he said, I always wanted to be an auto mechanic. So with a lot of, you know, pushing from us. He quit his job as a doctor, opened up a garage, became an auto mechanic, and eventually became one of those guys who was building like formula race cars and actually did make quite a bit of money at it.
Right.
But within 3 months, his back pain was gone and never came back.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
And he loved doing what he was doing.
He was very happy.
That is incredible. And more people need to do something like that.
Absolutely.
How do you find that passion? How do you really find it? Will the test help them?
The test will help. You can just go get the book, The Passion Test. It's $12.95 on Amazon or something like that. I mean, it really is a good read by my friends who did it. And the other thing is just to look back and say, what makes me wake up? Where do I get the most energy? What excites me? One of the things we're teaching in our book is not to so much ask what the world needs, but to ask what you need to do to feel alive. Because when you're alive, you're doing what the world needs. Each of us is like a cell in a body. And I was listening to one of your ads while we were waiting, about the carnivore. Mm-hmm. Went to President Reagan's office, and each of us is like a cell in a body. And when those cells are not functioning well, they're getting cancer or whatever, then things don't work. But if every person does what they're meant to do, means follows their passion, we're going to have all the artists, the musicians, the lawyers, the bakers, the chefs, the doctors, the nurses, etc. And I don't want a doctor working on me that doesn't love being a doctor, I can tell you.
No, not at all. Not at all.
These are the guys that make the mistakes. We've seen them. They're not good.
You know, we're all human. We have our ups and downs in life. We've got our tragedies and our personal things that happen. But I think the secret is, and you've illustrated this over the years, is that you need to be able to pull out of that because it's going to happen to us. We're going to have our down spots in life, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm writing a book called Effortless Success, and it doesn't mean you don't have to work. We do. I think Thomas Edison said, when your vocation feels like a vacation, then you've figured it out. But we're all going to have challenges. I believe that we have challenges in order to grow and develop qualities like love, compassion, perseverance, etc. Otherwise, we don't develop. Golf balls, we know now, they have these little divots in them. And when they first created golf balls, they were smooth. And the more they got hit by the club and little divots were put in it by the club, the more accurately they flew. And I think people are the same way. You know, the more challenges we handle and develop skills and develop qualities like perseverance and strength and courage and compassion, we become more effective. So we have to be tempered by life's experience. And I believe also there's some research now. There's very interesting research being done, but people doing hypnotic age regression and taking people back to before they were born. And over 2,000 people that have been documented in one book actually remember choosing their parents, choosing their gender, choosing their sexual preferences, whether they were going to have handicaps or not, what color they would be, etc., because there were lessons they needed to learn. And so, you know, when the kids are saying, well, I didn't ask you to be my parents, I always say, yes, you did.
That's so true.
Yeah.
So true. Barbara Marx Hubbard, 82 years old, remarkable person.
Yes.
Has what is called the conscious evolution. Mm-hmm. And did she influence you?
Yes. Yes. She really helped me understand and take my work from a personal level. I mostly work with individuals up until recently and corporations, but still working with individuals in those organizations to really look at how do we transform a world? How do we transform a society? And the idea that conscious evolution means evolution by choice, not evolution by chance. And it doesn't mean that we are totally at cause, because what happens is there seems to be an evolutionary impulse in the universe. It was interesting. I was down in Texas, and I met this guy, and we were doing some work together, and he asked me a question out of the blue. He said, what's the purpose of the universe? I'd never really thought about that. And then I thought, what's the only thing I know for sure about the universe? That if you believe the physicists, the universe is expanding. So I said, well, the purpose of the universe is to expand. And he said, right. And I went, oh, good, I got it right. And but the idea is, as the universe is expanding, there is an evolution that wants to occur through us as people. And so we have this, we can tune in to what is wanting to emerge in us and through us for all of humanity and literally all of Earth, because we have so much effect on it. So I think that we have the ability now. We know that we need to choose to become ecologically sustainable, or this environment that we live in will not be able to sustain us.
No, that's true.
You know, we've seen animals that evolved like the dinosaurs, They got to a point where they couldn't sustain themselves. So we're being asked, I think, to become more cooperative. I was talking to an evolutionary biologist by the name of Elizabeth Satoris. She lives in Greece, and she's an amazing woman. And she was teaching us that evolution occurs when there's a crisis in the environment, so that the things in the environment have to evolve in order to survive. And they always evolve by becoming more complex. So what happened was we first had bacteria, was the first life form, single-celled organisms, and they ate up everything there was to eat up, and they started eating up each other. So some of the bacteria got together and combined into double-cell bacteria. Now they were too big for the single-cell bacteria to eat. So that was an evolutionary leap that has led to, you know, the frogs and crawling out of the ocean and turning into the animals that have evolved into, you know, apes and now us. And we're now at a time when we have to evolve in order to survive the environment we've created, which is polluted, which is running out of food and clean water. And if we don't turn that around within the next 4 to 20 years, depending on which scientist you listen to, we won't be around. So we have to choose to evolve and get along better and not poison each other and not destroy each other with nuclear weapons and so on and so forth.
How many people, percentage-wise, on this planet do you think practice that?
You know, that's a good question, and I don't know that I really have an answer. What I do know is I watched a film recently with Paul Hawken, who's an evolutionary guy who works with the group called the Bioneers, which is working on ecological sustainability. And he showed a movie there are literally a million organizations that are devoted to consciousness, social justice, and ecological sustainability, grassroots organizations, millions of them. And he was running them by like credits at the end of a movie like Star Wars. And he said, if we were to watch this at the speed it's running, it would take 2.5 weeks for this list to run out. So I think there's a lot of people under the radar that are not getting the press and the media, but are doing amazing work. And what we see that's happening, you know, the Golden Motorcycle Gang's about, and what this book is leaning toward, is these groups discovering each other, starting to work in synergy. And when they all come together, they're a massive force. There's no leadership. It's all grassroots, just like the Occupy Wall Street group. And so we're seeing a lot of emergence of the kinds of people. So I would guess hundreds of millions. I don't, you know, out of 7 billion, I don't know exactly what percent that would be, but easily that. Just the fact that there's 500 million chicken soup books in print would let me know that there's a lot of people that are waking up to this.
True. See, I don't think government leaders understand this.
I don't think so either.
Yeah. And to me, it should be required reading if you're going to be a presidential candidate or something.
Yeah, absolutely. let's not go there. Or, unless you want to, whatever.
You have been called America's number one success coach. When you talk to groups of people, how do you get them motivated? How do you get someone motivated who just, doesn't it have to be from within first?
It does. It does. My job is to first awaken in them the possibility that it can happen, and then to also teach them how to be responsible. In my book, The Success Principles, the first chapter is take 100% responsibility for your life. You have to give up complaining and blaming. And I show people why that's to their advantage, why they need to be at cause rather than a victim in their life. And we begin to look at the fact that all the things you complain about are things that you have control over at some level. No one complains about gravity. You never see an 85-year-old person bent over walking down the street in a walker going, "Gravity? I hate gravity. Gravity sucks." And, you know, because there's no option. So if you're complaining about something, it actually means that it can be different and you're not willing to risk doing whatever it takes to make it different, called leave an abusive relationship. I'd rather complain about my wife. Complain about the government rather than do something about changing it. So we complain about things we have some control over, but we are unwilling to risk creating because it's inconvenient, it's scary, whatever. When people really begin to get that and see that they are more responsible than they've ever given themselves credit for, then we can start to look at what is their life purpose. And when people get that, they kind of get excited. And then we look at what's your vision of your life. What creates motivation is having a picture of something I want and believing it's possible to get it. And that's why a lot of people in prison are not clear about what they want, or they don't believe it's possible to get it with the skills and the competencies and the awarenesses and insights that they have. And so they turn to things that are, you know, criminal as opposed to, you know, legitimate. But I really believe that all of us have a vision of what we would like to have, but most of us have gone into resignation because we don't have the skills to do it. Revolution is caused by people having upward mobile images without the skills or the opportunity to achieve them. That's why you saw the whole Arab Spring happen. Young people, educated with kind of Western education, they're on the internet, they're seeing everything that's possible on YouTube and American television and movies, and they're going, wait a second, we don't have that. I want that. And you know, if there's no real road to get that, then you get revolution rather than evolution.
You were featured in the movie and the book The Secret, very heavily, as a matter of fact, and zillions of people have seen that.
Yeah.
What do you think about the law of attraction? Why does it work?
Well, what I understand of it, it's worked in my life, that I know. You know, anecdotally, I could tell you 20 stories. But how it works, from what I understand, talking to quantum physicists and people who have studied this in great depth, is that when something, everything in the universe vibrates. You know, the radio signal that's going out is the vibration. It has a frequency, mm-hmm. and there's a carrier code that allows all this information called our voices to go out, and there's a frequency so people can dial it, and there's amplitude, which how loud it is. So basically what happens is that our thoughts and our emotions are broadcast. We know from research that was done at Duke University that they had astronauts up in the space capsule by the moon, and they had them open envelopes at on the hour. And they had students at Duke University in the parapsychology labs close their eyes and try to figure out what was in the envelope. And it was always a shape, like a square, a circle, a triangle, a pentagon, whatever. And they had, like, you know, way beyond statistical chance accuracy, 250,000 miles away, quarter of a million miles away. Dr. Masaru Emoto in Japan, I don't know if you know his work.
Oh, sure, he's been on the show. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
incredible.
Here's a group of people, 10,000 people get together in Japan, send love and gratitude to all the water around the world, and all those water samples are tested, and they've been changed.
And they're gorgeous under a microscope, aren't they?
Beautiful crystals that, you know, that form as a result of it. I've seen the movies of them, and so we know that a thought can travel around the earth. So given that, if we're a vibration or we're vibrating at a level of abundance, then we will attract other people and things that are vibrating at the same level. So things that are vibrating at the same level in harmonic resonance are attracted to each other. That's why rich people tend to hang out with rich people. Poor people hang out with poor people. People in prison tend to get out of prison and hang out with other ex-prisoners because they're vibrating at the same level of consciousness. So when we focus on gratitude for having what we already have, that gratitude actually attracts more things to be grateful for. And when you close your eyes and you act as if you visualize having your ideal car, your ideal mate, your ideal job, you actually start attracting to you opportunities, resources, people, etc., that will help you manifest that.
And I found, Jack, that if you don't push, you just let it happen, it's more apt to work for you.
It is. I do think action's required, but it really is action that comes from what I call intuition or inspiration rather than the ego.
Yeah.
The ego wants to kind of control and push things. We know that one of the things about the law of attraction is that when you're focusing on lack, that's what you get more lack. So when you're impatient, if you're impatient about something, it means you're focused on the not having of it, as opposed to being, you know, in a state of positive expectation that it's on its way. It's very, very different, very nuanced. But when people get this, it's very important. So patience and allowing, surrendering, paying attention to the little signals that come, the songs you hear on the radio that stick out, the newspaper articles that jump out, things that people say, your dreams, all of these are giving you data and feedback about what your next step should be.
It's critical. Hold on, Jack. We're at the top of the hour. Fast hour already. We're going to bring in William Gladstone with you when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.